for now, these are only audio podcasts.
Woohoo!
Except for that, when Dean takes a
shot. Yeah, I really wish I was recording that.
This is the Meteor Club Podcast, a weekly roundtable discussion about all things Meteor.
Welcome, Meteor fans, to the Meteor Club Podcast. I am your host, Josh Owens, along with my co-host, Dean.
Hey.
Welcome, Dean.
Thanks.
Today, we're going to be talking about Meteor and Raspberry Pis, but I guess, I mean, that's almost like Internet of Things, right?
Yeah.
IoT. We're going to talk about all the things that we can control from Meteor.
Yes. I saw the dev shop, I think it was back in August, and Lewis was one of the longer talks there. Like, number one, like, I'm super interested in aquaponics. I don't grow any fish and food here, but it's definitely like an interesting thing to me. So I invited him on the show, and then it immediately came to my mind that Ryan from Cabinet Grow, is that what you said?
Yes, Cabinet Grow.
Okay. Ryan from Cabinet Grow was also doing similar things, and he's been talking about that in the Meteor Club Slack chat room. And so, like, it felt like we had the right guests and everything, so it lined up, and here we are talking about it. So, welcome to the show, Lewis.
Thank you.
We'll let Ryan go first. Ryan, why don't you tell us about Cabinet Grow?
All right. Cabinet Grow is a company. We build self-contained horticultural cabinets, kind of focused on the cannabis industry. The company's been doing it for about 4 years now. Don't quote me. I'm not the corporate guy. You know, they've been building the cabinets, have a pretty good established customer base, and I came in kind of to move into the IoT space a little bit and bring some technology to a product that was already out there.
Nice. All right. So it looks like we got Lewis back. You want to tell us a little bit about what Grove is, Lewis?
Yep. Sorry. Definitely. So our mission is to decentralize agriculture. Basically, the way that the world produces and ships its food is unsustainable, and everyone's really lost touch with where their food comes from. So we make hardware, but also software and services.
All right. So we were asking Luis about Dev Shop.
Oh, the Dev Shop talk. So I'm a big fan of Dev Shop, had watched it all along and wanted to kind of share our story for the past year. So it was basically the narrative from last August through this August. We created, sold, and shipped about just over 100 of our systems, and the app that went along with it was built in Meteor. So I wanted to kind of share those experiences with everyone.
Nice. Now, any chance we're going to see you on Shark Tank sometime?
We thought about it, but we don't think our products do right. And those guys get the worst deals. I love Shark Tank, but I always feel like they're getting ripped by the investors.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing. I think the first Meteor app that'll be on Shark Tank will be Foot Cardigan. They're also in the Meteor Club Slack chat room, and the CTO posted the other day that they're going to be on Shark Tank October 9th.
This Friday, yeah.
You should watch tomorrow. They're not on Meteor quite yet. Their Meteor platform's almost done, but that's kind of interesting as well. They're going to be doing like order fulfillment, that kind of thing, using Meteor. Maybe you guys can just talk about like how Meteor factors into working with the Raspberry Pi and that kind of stuff.
Lewis, you want to take it first?
Sure. Our hardware is built on Particle. So they're a startup in San Francisco that builds Wi-Fi connected microcontrollers. But they still use, you know, the antiquated technology of C++ and Arduino. So our actual language for writing the hardware is not JavaScript, but they have a really nice interface of publication. So right in your code, you just say particle.publish, and every time you do that, you can subscribe on a server, I think, to a JavaScript server, and it's just a stream of events. So Meteor was really clear, okay, stream of events from the hardware. We want to get a stream of data down to the browser. How does that happen? So it was a really easy hookup between the two.
From a different perspective, rather than going full Meteor on the actual Raspberry Pi hardware, we run Meteor in the cloud for the app-based, but on the actual hardware, we're actually running Node on the hardware itself. There's a few C, C++ drivers linked over to talk to the hardware itself. But other than that, we just run Node processes directly on the Pi. And that allows us to use you know, DDP to push information directly to the Meteor server. And then we're also using MQTT, which is a IoT communications protocol. We just use that for the real-time streaming so that, you know, reducing the load on the server and talking to the hardware directly takes place over MQTT.
So what kind of stuff do you guys use DDP for from the device?
Using DDP for events configuration, MQTT is pretty much exclusively used for streaming of the telemetry.
Okay.
DDP is used for events, firing off callbacks, functions, whatnot, talking to the server.
Probably the most interesting thing is that there are so many startups around growing things, and the fact that, you know, you guys are using, I mean, these are two companies, right? And there's so many more out there that are growing things and controlling it with hardware. It's really an interesting space to be in. What's been the most challenging thing so far with kind of building this kind of stuff?
I'll say from my perspective, the most challenging part is honestly just getting the hardware layer stable. You know, running off the Pi and some of the hardware, when you're talking about building a controller out of it, stability is really the name of the game. You can't afford any crashing or anything else. So honestly, it's the layer upon layer of watchdog this, watchdog that, crash recovery this. It's the air handling that has been absolutely the most challenging part of it all.
Yeah, definitely. Seconded for every single one of those. I'm pretty lucky. We have a really good team of other engineers. So I'm strictly covering a little bit of the firmware, but we have an electrical engineer, a firmware engineer, a couple of mechanical engineers. So building it has certainly been its own challenges, but I've been a little had the benefit of not being as deep into those problems. Working with Particle was an interesting experience in itself since they're a startup themselves. So they had their Spark Core, which really wasn't ready for wide scale usage in a product. Like, we had to manufacture in the Wi-Fi put the Wi-Fi credentials in at the time of manufacturing. And then the Photon came out. There was some bugs that weren't as acknowledged right when they launched it. Like, it was still 6 weeks before we were even able to compile our existing firmware for the Photon, which was their support. But I still think 2015, the application, building an app that is cross-platform, that is lives up to the standards that we all have every day of just using our iPhones and our Android phones, like that really just beautiful, silky smooth motion and animation and interaction, is still really hard to do. And Meteor doesn't tackle that. Like, it doesn't make the design and interaction any easier, so there's still a lot to learn and to understand and get good at for just the simple front end, if you will.
I can definitely see that perspective on it. Coming from my end, I do the hardware and the back end and the software, but I am nowhere near a front end guy, a UI, UX, so I don't really tackle that too much. Meteor for me has made building the platform to hand off to my UI and UX so much easier. So much, you know, everything's taken care of for me on the back end, reactivity, everything else, but I can't really speak to the UI UX side of things.
Lewis, particularly, like, how did you guys come to the decision to use Meteor? Like, who made that decision, and do you guys feel like you made the right one so far?
Yeah. So a little bit of backstory to give context. I graduated from MIT 2014. Meteor hit 1.0, I think March of 2014. They'd had a couple events they sponsored, a couple of the people who worked there had graduated from. So I'd gotten my introduction that way. They even like sponsored part of our user interface class, and that was like, hey, you guys are going to build a UI. Here's this really easy way to get it going. So come time that June when we're like, hey, let's really start in the app, it was, what do you know? What will be the fastest? And it was looking at either like Rails versus Meteor, and then, you know, it's like Rails plus Angular whatever versus Meteor, and for us it was clear that it was going to be faster. I did some research at the time. I reached out to like Percolate Studios, I reached out to MBG themselves and Differential and asked about their experiences, and no one had anything negative to say. There's frays at the edges of what you need to do to really professionally engineer software with Meteor, but it was just the fastest route for us. So right now we're building the next version of our product and kind of next generation of the app. We're going to build a native app, which is not going to be Cordova. It's going to be built with Swift and the actual platform for Apple and Android, and trying to evaluate if a Meteor backend is still the right call for us. You know, even though there's this beautiful vision for the web of this real-time place, you have all these streams of data and everything's connected over sockets, you know, most of the world still operates on HTTP. So if you want to integrate, you know, if you want to operate an API, a public API, there's still not much guidance at all for how you serve up a DBP API the correct way. And it's really easiest to just give a REST API with tokens, integrating that with any of these other kind of like connected device platforms that are starting to form, whether that's HomeKit, whether that's Google's Google Thread or whatever their attempts are there. It's a lot more difficult to connect with those over anything other than a RESTful API. So really taking into consideration the current state of things, we're still trying to figure out if Meteor is the best option.
Interesting. Well,
the only thing I can say is the reason we haven't really ran into too many of those issues is it was a decision made on to kind of take the Meteor philosophy and our design decision and try to run JavaScript everywhere we possibly could, you know, running everything on Node. And we've had to, you know, tap into the C side a little bit, write a couple libraries, but just keeping it, you know, keeping it on Node beginning to end, whether that be with Meteor, whatever other packages are added on there, keeping it beginning to end really helped with that interconnecting layer. That's why DDP was so easy to get up and working, just, you know, import DDP.
You got any questions, Dean?
Yeah, about the REST DDP, I see that there's an impedance mismatch somewhat. Is it a challenging one to expose a REST endpoint from Meteor, or where is the challenge there, in your opinion?
It's not. You can build RESTful APIs over top of DDP. You can definitely expose those, and that might be what we do. So it's not so much technical inability, but just the support. I'm surprised that I don't see more DDP APIs, and there's not more guidance from MDG on that. I've tried to look pretty hard of what's out there, and I think I've found like two public ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you hook into a Meteor app, you can figure out if there's a DDP API and start doing stuff yourself. But
right.
It's
a newer protocol, but yeah, that is really like the core innovation of Meteor, and the Meteor adoption would be helped greatly by DDP adoption.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a big flag to me that they're not the official stewards of like the DDP node package, that they're not really trying to push adoption outside of Meteor apps themselves and just make it easy, you know, provide a normal NPM package, provide a Java library, provide.
Like, yeah. You know, I mean, that's really interesting to me that you bring that up, because they actually tried to do that with Blaze and I don't think it worked very well. I don't know. To me, it would make a lot more sense to probably put a node package out that works with DDP and then pull that in and use it in the Meteor app, right? Because Meteor apps can't import NPM packages. And I don't know, that might make a heck of a lot more sense, and you get, you know, double the bang for your buck there, I guess, so to speak. So we've got the Crater AMA coming up on Saturday. So maybe we should ask them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Meteor for me and a couple of the engineers personally, like, we were node developers, and it just stinks that you can't share more of your code. Like, I tried to sit down and write a CLI for our Groves, and it was like, there's no way to do it with just a Meteor package.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of hack stuff together if you say like Meteor run once and you happen to give it a command, but it stinks that code that you write for Meteor is very, very difficult and in some ways not possible to use outside of a Meteor app.
Yeah. The thing they need to do there is, at least in that particular case, is expand the build system and the control system that they're using to run Meteor, which they haven't really done. I know they just revamped a lot of it for 1.2, but they didn't really put anything kind of custom where you could put in your own commands. And I think that would be super interesting. Frankly, it would be kind of awesome to just install, like, I know this probably wouldn't be in their best interest, but you know, they're probably thinking about this for Galaxy. They want to be you to be able to say Meteor deploy, and it's either going to go to Galaxy or it's going to go to the free hosting. But what if like Modulus or Heroku could come out with a package that kind of takes care of things behind the scenes? I think that would be pretty awesome too. So yeah, I don't know. Definitely a lot they could do, and a lot of people have wanted that for a long time. So
yeah, I felt the command line vacuum. I looked into a couple of things, the closest thing I got was basically like if all of your stuff is in a single method call, you can invoke that method call from the command line and get its result from the command line. So I've figured it is okay. It wasn't like the smoothest experience, but you're right that they're very, very close in this kind of fiber-based API. No one is currently doing scripting in JavaScript because it blows compared to Python or Ruby, the synchronous stuff. You know, they're very, very close to leveraging a lot of the good Meteor technology into those kinds of scripts, but it's just not there yet. Oh, well, IoT. Yeah, I would love to definitely hear more about that. And you kind of take me back to, about the aquaponics, particularly to when I had my first fish tank. And I said, well, where does the fish poop go? And they're like, it's just under the gravel. And I thought, like, how I have to do chores to, like that would never be acceptable in my house. Like,
yeah,
how come it's acceptable that it just sits there? And then I was, you know, brought into the know about that. So are you using aquaponics for grow, or is it a different system for providing nutrients? How do the plants get the nutrients?
We see it as two basic schools of thought. You've hydroponics and ecoponics. So in hydroponics, it's very sterile and controlled. Ecoponics is the philosophy of having an ecosystem do most of the balancing for you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So aquaponics is one version of that. The fish, you know, are the source of the nitrogen. It's the nitrogen cycle that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So from their waste, both in their poop and also just their respiration, there's ammonia present in that, and then the bacteria that you cultivate within this ecosystem breaks down into nitrite, and that's what's the fertilizer for the plants. And it's cool because that's been around for thousands of years. Like even today, our CEO just got back from a trip to Nepal, and you know their rice paddies there use aquaponics. It's just fish swimming around the rice paddies at your feet. So it's long been this kind of understanding of like fish and like fish grow food and ecosystems. Like we know how to live in symbiosis together.
They might even have cultural stories really that embody that wisdom in all kinds of systems for passing on that knowledge. It's very neat.
So the real question is, like, are grow cabinets, are they going to put fish tanks in their cabinets now?
No, we take, you know, I love the aquaponics approach. We're after a little bit different of a market segment. We're really into pushing the plants as far as they go. That's actually one of the cool features that we were developing internally, is some ways to track that. But we're looking for ways to absolute maximize productivity out of the cabinet itself. Whereas in ecoponics, you're really looking to keep that balance. You're balancing out a system so it works in harmony. Sometimes you give up a little bit on this side to gain some more over here, and it's a big balancing act. Whereas we're really just focused on grow the plants themselves as big and as fast as you can, and then, you know, tweak it from there. Whereas in Lewis's approach, you know, food production, absolutely the sustainability. We're building in those efficiencies to our cabinets, but it's just a different approach to what you're after. In the ecoponics, you're looking for the balance. In what we're trying to do, you're looking for, economy, producing as much as you can for as little as you can.
Just an oddball question. Genetic modifications, is that part of the industry, or has there been a comment about whether that's good or bad? With the caveat, with the caveat that selective breeding of plants, which has been done over history, is eventually changing the genome of the plant. It's more gentle, but like as in The Botany of Desire, which mm-hmm. was a great movie.
Love that movie.
Very informative about like how humans have, you know, lest anybody look at this grow cabinet as a you know, perversion of what the plant wants to do, you know, maximizing yield. It's like, no, we've, you know, bananas that we eat today are unrecognizable. Nobody who says they do paleo who eats modern day bananas really does paleo because the sugar content is a lot higher. So, but I guess my direct question is like, though this is an endlessly fun topic, like, but are direct genetic modifications involved in the industry at this point yet?
Define industry.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Yeah, if you're talking about the food industry, absolutely. It's all over the place.
I meant the
cannabis industry, yes. Industry, yeah. As far as I'm aware, no, it's just selective breeding taken to the absolute, you know, capitalistic extreme. Some of the traits you can pull out nowadays are unreal compared to what was out there 20 years ago. So, yeah, you know, the distinction between genetically modifying and, you know, just selective breeding, it's a real fine line. I'm no biologist, but, you know, when you talk to somebody and they're talking about how they've achieved some of the GMO modifications, it's really just accelerating what you could do with selective breeding. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in other cases, they're splicing in crazy stuff, and I'm not even going to talk to that.
Yeah.
To my knowledge right now, no, but the selective breeding we've done has absolutely changed what's out there.
What's out there in the gym, yeah. Yeah, my experience, I tried to do a 24-hour hackathon at an old company of mine. And the first two, I won by using Meteor. And I was like, this is like bringing a gun to a knife fight. This is not even fun anymore. So the third one, somebody had an idea to do an indoor gardening project. And we were like, Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, and someone brought the soldering gun. And what we had at the end of 24 hours was a rickety tower of wood and PVC that barely stood up, and a 24-hour, one of those plug-in $12 24-hour timers to turn the water on and off. So I'm definitely curious, how does one get into the more higher tech stuff? Because that was all that I had time to do.
Yeah, that sounds like our first prototype for sure.
Oh, yeah.
I've had a few of those in my garage.
Yeah. No, those are great, you know, and you could certainly teach kids a thing or two about it. But if I was looking to flex my coding chops, I would have wound up a bit disappointed. Is it in cycling the lights, or what are some of the things that the code is doing while it's
working? Oh, okay. Luis, do you want to talk to that?
Sure. So for our systems, it comes down to pretty much the pumps and the lights of what's actually being controlled. We can measure other aspects, temperature, humidity, even like your water level, but the real only stuff that the code is managing that's dynamic is those two. So you can say what you're growing, and it will adjust your light schedule, so how long the lights are on for a given day. And our LEDs also have a color variance to them, so it'll understand if your tomato is later in its life, then it probably wants more warm light versus lots of greens. Just want your like full spectrum as much as you can, red and blue. So you're just blasting it with all of the colors. And then the pumps, you can either do a constant watering cycle, which means that the entire day, the plants are just sitting in a tray with their roots suspended in water. And that's how most hydroponics happens. It's called like shallow water culture, NFT.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also been experimenting a lot, and this is our recommendation now for when customers start. Your bed has a period of each hour that it gets flooded with water, and then the rest of it remains dry. So it's usually only 10 or 15 minutes per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And in our beds, we use a substance called Hydroton. So it's these little clay pebbles. They're just a few centimeters in diameter. And those are really great for the bacteria because they're very porous. So as the water runs in and out, it aerates really well and gives the bacteria a great home to live in. We found that the bacteria thrives a lot more when you have all of that surface area of the hydrogen that gets flooded and drained rather than a tray that just suspends the plants in the water.
Mm-hmm.
So the hydrogen is the little things that look like Cocoa Puffs, right?
Exactly. Yep. They're like possibly like the least toddler safe.
Nice. Yeah.
I'm not even going to admit it, but I actually used them as paving for my old yard because I had so many left over after.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, my entire side of the yard, it was all hydrogen. It looked great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of Zen garden-like. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's about it for like a lot of the complex code on the device.
Okay. No, that's neat. I mean,
from,
you know.
From the other side, from our side, it's, again, looking to control and measure and monitor and tweak as much as possible. That's really what it's all about. It's about the data analytics in the end. Mm. It is applying, you know, is learning from the cabinet. So our hardware is actually looking at temperature, humidity, CO2. If it's a hydroponic system, it's going to be looking at pH and TDS. That, you know, that sounded really complicated to get pushed into Meteor, but that was actually pretty easy. Just because, you know, there are companies out there that build gateways, you just write a little serial protocol. There's a serial client for Node, and, you know, just talk to all these different sensors, pull in everything. And as far as what it's actually controlling, right now it's just controlling the light and the environmental controls. So it's turning on and off the light, and it's also turning on and off the CO2 solenoid valve for dosing CO2 into the environment. It's also controlling the watering, you know, pumps and whatnot. But as far as that, there's not too much to control on the cabinet. Our IoT side is really more about the data analytics, you know. We use Meteor as the interface to it all, but actually applying information. So when a customer goes in and, you know, pops in their strain information, they're growing this type of plant. And throughout that plant's life cycle, the cabinet's keeping track of it. They're entering information through the cell phone app and eventually, you know, correlating all that data together to say, you know, this guy grew strawberries at 80 degrees. This guy grew strawberries at 70 degrees. Who has better strawberries? And then using Meteor to push that information out in a social atmosphere is really what we're trying to do. Hmm. And the IoT platform just allows us to collect enough information to make intelligent decisions and to bring enough value to the person to say, you know, hey, I want to bring out my phone and type in what my plant's doing today.
Yeah.
Right, right.
That's interesting too, because you talk about like the data analytics. How have you felt about Mongo, and are you guys using any kind of aggregations to kind of come up with some of that data?
Yes.
Sounds like interesting response.
I think I struck a nerve.
Well, I will say this. Everything's currently in Mongo. We've had to, there's a lot of workarounds for getting what we need done out of Mongo in an efficient way. Actually, on my list, I don't even want to speak to Mongo because on the to-do list is transitioning over into Postgres. The one thing that we probably will keep in Mongo is the time series data, mm-hmm. because the way the storage adapter we wrote for storing time series data into Mongo is very efficient. But for the relational information, honestly, I'd rather type joins. It's hard, I know.
I would say the problem here is a Meteor problem, right? Like, I don't know that it's necessarily a Mongo problem, per se. Meteor makes joins expensive because they're reactive. It's really just not awesome to work with that. I mean, even today, I had a meeting with a client who, you know, you pull up a page and it's doing a join and bringing 3,000 records on, and it's like, that's really painful to do with Meteor and not perform it at all. I'm very much interested to try this new tracker auto run library put out. I suggested that as a solution today. Like, hey, let's try it. Like, I haven't even taken a dive into the code for published composite, but I have a feeling that that's where the performance problems lie. Because if you look at the code, I think it's doing like an M plus one, right? For every record you have, it's going to go look up another child record. So, like, it's non-performant to do 3,000 queries to the Mongo database instead of like three. Even if the same amount of data is coming over, you're making Mongo do a heck of a lot more work by asking for all those queries individually. So,
But I disagree that it's a Meteor problem then, because inherently it's whether your joins happen at the application or at the database.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could agree on some level, but I mean, the problem with asking a lot of queries to a database is still going to exist no matter what database you put in there, right? So it was always more efficient to there comes a trade-off point, right? So if you're talking about SQL, in my experience, you can work a query and get some joins going together and get it all in one query, and likely it'll be more performant most of the time. And doing that single query is usually faster, but doing like 100 individual queries was never faster because you're adding all that round trip, you know, TCP overhead and all that kind of stuff to it.
Yeah, I would make one suggestion on the Postgres side and just say that, like, over time, a lot of the data joining problems I've solved have been by pre-computing stuff in some form, and materialized views are pretty nice. So, like, conceptually, they're a view. The data lives in tables for real. But if the view is joining up, you know, seven different tables, by making it a materialized view, you always have the contents of that view on disk and just retrievable immediately. And for the cost of when you're updating any one of those seven tables, it has to update the materialized view. But it's been better than a lot of ad hoc creating separate reporting tables that aren't linked to it.
To this whole topic, Mongo, I believe, is a good tool for certain aspects. In others, I personally don't feel it's the best tool for relational data.
Yeah. They claim that it has a different sweet spot.
And honestly, for my time series data storage adapter, I wouldn't pick anything other than Mongo. Mm-hmm. Just because the way it's, you know, I can do updates and counts, and the way it's writing the update, I can pre-allocate the entire day's worth of tables, you know, on the create, and everything's there. It's very quick for that. But the joins, it's just a headache.
Fair enough. So what about you guys, Lewis? How do you guys feel about Mongo?
I love Mongo for what they say I should love it for. Like, it's just really conceptually easy. Like, I have an object, I save it, I get it. You really have to come at it with an understanding of what your views are going to look like, what your main queries are, so you structure your data around that. Mm-hmm. Ryan touched a little bit on it of, like, the real data sweet spot from this is starting to learn from your data and understanding how these things are growing and be able to grow better with it. For that, we have pretty simple learning models right now. All of them are just reflexive of, like, okay, check your pH level and ammonia level, and do you have fish? Okay, tell them their ammonia is too high, they need to lower it. Like, it's just a couple rules that are being applied, and we're giving feedback. But as we start to get more complex and understanding, like, this basil plant with these environmental conditions, let's understand all of the times a basil plant has ever been grown and understand the different conditions that it's been happened, that they occurred. When you take in, like, those more difficult learning models, I can only guess at whether it'll be good or bad. But I'm kind of worried about those types of things because, again, like you mentioned, that's really relational. So far, it's been easy. And we even didn't optimize on our time series. What it sounds like Ryan did, you know, instead of having one document per reading, you have like an hour's worth or a day's worth of readings in one document. Mm-hmm. We built that adapter and ran into like a couple bugs. Like, what if we did just do one document per reading and we only have 50 or 60 customers and it was running just fine? We're like, let's just go with the easiest thing. Like, we'll optimize when we get there. Even if you're not going to spend the time to do it right, it'll still run just fine.
And I've heard a lot about machine learning and there's a lot of interest there, but what, and I'm sure you guys will, like, you know, are looking at integrating that kind of stuff. But what's interesting too, is that you also have the kind of social effects of learning too. Do you think that they're equally important strategies to getting a more optimized approach, or can, you know, can the machines do it all?
Yeah, I believe that the social aspect in the near term is almost going to give better gains than the machine learning aspect. The machine learning right now haven't even started. Obviously, that's in the long-term plan, but you need a large data set right, to really start with that. Before you get to that large data set, that social aspect is really what's going to drive the improvements to the system.
Right.
So long term, I believe it's the machine learning. And in the short term, leverage the social aspect to make those gains while you collect enough data to optimize via machine learning. That's my perspective on it.
Yeah, yeah. And meanwhile, you're getting people talking to each other, your customers, and you're accumulating network effects from, like, a business standpoint, why it makes sense to get in. Yeah, that's neat.
especially for growing food, which is one of our oldest forms of social interaction and one that we've kind of lost. We love that aspect of bringing community around it. And like, this is not my own thought, but what people have talked about, the sweet spot between for computers as a tool is the human computer interaction. So even if machine learning can understand and optimize a lot, there's still a lot of benefit to your user in offering it as suggestions rather than automatically doing it. Because then there's a level of education of how it is working, and you could run this on your own if you didn't have a machine telling you what to do. Like, you're still gaining skills here instead of just having this thing that's running in the background.
Right. So planning for the zombie apocalypse.
Yeah.
That's what this is all about.
It's funny.
I'll tell you one thing. I'll run over to Lewis's in case of zombie apocalypse. You know?
Yeah.
Well, but you're already there, so you can grab some of your... You can take some plants with you, right? I'm sure you guys do, like, research growing in your cabin.
Yeah. Lots of basil. Lots of basil, actually.
Lots of basil.
So there's a place in Chicago that I haven't seen firsthand yet. It's called The Plant. Also goes by Bubbly Dynamics. And I lived across the street from John Adel, who runs it. It just sounds like this dreamland. So I'll describe what it sounds like in my head. I don't know how much this is actually true, but it's like a 3-month-long conveyor belt through a warehouse in Chicago where plants go from seedlings to adult plants uniformly. And I think there's fish and, you know, nitrogen cycle stuff going on there. And even the color of the plant leaves and the height of the plant along the conveyor belt is like measured and fed into a feedback system to say like, oh, the plant should be 4.5 inches by this time. It just kindles my imagination. Of course, that one is strictly on the, like, you know, machine learning and algorithm tuning side, because it's like one facility, but it kindles my imagination to think like how this warehouse in Chicago could be producing, you know, large amounts of food that wouldn't have to be trucked from the outer regions of the city into the city. It's a really interesting industry.
It really is. That's what drove me. I mean, I've been driven to it from multiple aspects. I came from the aerospace industry into this, and cool. You know, there's so many applications out there. As Lewis said, it's one of humanity's oldest problems. Let's grow some food.
Yeah.
To loop back to your earlier question about GMOs, I mean, if you look at our agriculture in the past 60 years, even 100 years, is we've really, as industrial revolution, the way we've changed agriculture to become so focused on growing so much, and the fear aspect of it is like, we're not going to have enough food. We're going to grow so quickly. We're going to have so many billion people that we're going to run out. So when we look at greenhouses, indoor agriculture, vertical farming, it's a different answer than to this kind of industrial agriculture, monocrop, GMOs. Mm-hmm. But I don't look at the guys who made that as, you know, evil or have done this bad thing, because everyone's worried about the same problem of like, how do we have enough food for everyone? It's just this new hopeful outlook of like, maybe we don't have to ravage all of our lands and spray all these pesticides to enable that. It's hard to come to a conclusive answer of like, yes, small scale organic agriculture is the answer, or futuristic vertical farms is the answer. But it's starting to realize that like sustainability and having enough food need to go hand in hand.
I 100% with Lewis on that. I do see a blend coming of home agriculture along with, you know, localized vertical farming. That's really the direction I see it going in. And the two play to each other. The efficiencies you find from one, we're really getting to the point, as you know, with technology the way it is. I mean, look at Meteor. You mentioned bringing a gun to a knife fight earlier. That's what Meteor is. I mean, imagine trying to do what we're trying to do 5 years ago. There's no way. I mean, I'm holding in my hands a 3D printed chassis to our next heart. I printed this out yesterday. I walked down the street. This just wasn't possible before.
Wow.
So the industry is moving so fast, and we're making these gains like what Lewis is doing and a few other players in the space are doing. It's just simply amazing how fast this particular market segment is moving.
Back to Lewis's point, you know, the thing I find interesting too is that I read a statistic that like 1/3 of all food that's shipped to stores just ends up going to waste. At least what you guys are building gets the consumer closer to the product that they're consuming, I guess.
Yeah, the waste in the whole chain are nuts. Because, you know, the waste at the farm and that they're picking out their best to give to the stores. And then the stores lose out both on what doesn't look good and what goes bad. And then even when it gets to your home, there's numbers like you throw away 1/4 of your food because it either goes bad or like it's just your parts that you don't eat and end up throwing away. Like by the time you get all the way to like your stomach, you know, half the food you've grown has been thrown out or more. It gets up to like 70% sometimes. It's logically doesn't. Yeah. You're just like, no, that can't, that, why?
Maybe that brings up an interesting point. Like, I'm kind of curious, like, you guys are going to sell to consumers, Lewis, and like, you guys have a price and I think you have a waiting list. But Ryan, it sounds like you guys sell directly to growers in states where it's completely legal or I guess medically, like it's legal in most places to grow that kind of stuff.
I should say that we target the cannabis industry because that's where a lot of people are using these products right now. Mm-hmm. But no, actually, we have guys growing, you know, habanero peppers and anything that they just want to take inside and grow on a small scale and keep it in a controlled environment. Yeah, we have plenty of people who do that too. It's not specific to cannabis, but a lot of people do use it for that.
So even if we just kept it to cannabis, mm-hmm. like sure. most of the states that have legalized it allow you to grow your own plants too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that seems like a legitimate use as well. Can people just like call you up and order a grow cabinet?
We ship worldwide, actually, yeah.
How much is that?
Oh, nice.
There's three different models. They range anywhere from about $799 up to $24, $25, I think, somewhere around there. I can't speak to the business side. I'm sorry. I'm behind. I'm so far into the code and everything else. I'm like, but no, the existing cabinets are amazing. They really are. And it's a great, you know, it's a great base to start pushing out these. It's a great platform to start pushing this technology out onto already. We have people in the field that are ready to just throw it in there. You know, we can start to learn. And that's what it's really about, is learning using Meteor, using the IoT devices, and using the technology to get a better, you know, user experience for one, so that they want to interact with it. And then two, learning from those interactions. And that's where Meteor really played in, was just simplifying that entire process.
When can we expect a Grove cabinet if we ordered one, and what's it going to cost?
Definitely. So, yeah, this past year we had our early adopter ecosystems. The product's called the ecosystem. Next week, next Wednesday, if you check our site, we're going to have the new product shots and the new product announced. So this will just be the Grove ecosystem, drop the early adopter. We're going to launch a Kickstarter. Probably the date as of now is like November 4th. And lowest pricing for that, the earliest backers will be about $2,800. And the MSRP suggested retail is going to be about $4,000-$4,500 at the very end. The price comes a lot from, it's not so utilitarian focused. There's actually a lot of really nice furniture design that goes into it. The guy that we work with to make this.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful cabinet. When you were doing the dev talk, I was looking at that just going, wow. I want one of those like in my office right here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's like a better version of IKEA, right? Like IKEA is kind of slick and is so-so on the quality, but that thing looks really, really slick, I got to say. It's got that nice, sleek aesthetic to it.
It really upped the sex appeal finding his name. Paul Wachusett Woodworking is the company. Like we use this, it's called Plyboo. It's bamboo plywood, and it just has such a nice finish to it. You can stain it darker or lighter if you want to match your cabinets or design of your house. But
and what's the website for that again?
It's grovelabs.io, G-R-O-V-E labs.io.
All right, yeah.
If someone wants to get started with IoT type stuff, what would you recommend?
Get some hardware, start tinkering. Honestly, you know.
What hardware would you recommend then? the Raspberry Pi or some Arduino stuff, or?
Personally, I'd recommend pick up one of the new Raspberry Pi 2s. They're the processor on there. It's a really good platform. Get a breakout board and a breadboard and some resistors and buttons and, you know, start hacking away at it. That's really the way to get into it, in my opinion, is to just start hacking on it.
Nice.
Okay.
What about you, Lewis?
Same recommendation. It depends a little if what background you're coming from. Like if you're more like circuit design and real hardware and you're trying to get into coding, I'd say maybe Arduino if you've seen it a little. And not even Arduino if you're going to go for the Photon. It's cheaper. You've got your Wi-Fi right there. So I'd say either Photon or Pi.
Yeah, and I'm curious. So given a Pi and an Arduino, I still feel like that doesn't get me to like the world of things that I can control. Like what are the next couple $100 to spend so that I can do something in the world?
Nothing. That's what you need. That's some wire, maybe a couple relays, you know, head down to the local, well, I guess you can't head down to Radio Shack anymore, but you know, pick up some relays, attach it to a motor, and you know, there's no economical barrier there. Just pick up a Pi and, you know, some random parts laying around, you can get started. You were kind of leaning towards, you know, why the Pi, not the Arduino. Mm-hmm. If you're really getting into heavy hardware stuff where you have to bit bang protocols and you're like really timing intensive, you're going to need the Arduino because it's you need a real time operating system. Linux is not an RTOS. It just flat out isn't. If you need to do timing, bit banging, or anything really deep data communications, then, yeah, you're going to need to pick up the Arduino. 90% of what you need to do these days is already wrapped. There's it's either on a serial bus or an I2C bus or something like that, and you can get away with using, you know, an embedded Linux machine for that.
Hmm. Nice. All right. So at the end of the show, we just name off something, a thought or something that you've run across this week or recently that really somehow makes your life better, and just tell us what it is and why.
What makes my life easier? I don't know. I haven't had anything make it easier lately.
So I do have one. Well, honestly, I've just been buying a lot of golf stuff lately. So I don't know. Maybe I'm at the right age or something, but I've started to get into golf and really been enjoying that. You know, my father-in-law gave me an old bag and some really crappy clubs, and I'm trying to learn on that stuff. And I was embarrassingly underdressed to go to I went and played with my dad and my brother on, like, last Sunday, and I was wearing, like, jeans and a T-shirt on the golf course. And so now, like, I've been getting some actual nice clothes and nicer bag and that kind of stuff, so I'm enjoying golf. I guess that's
plaid pants.
All right.
No
plaid pants. Forward to seeing that.
No plaid pants.
You know, that reminds me. I did find one thing this week, and that is Bluetooth earbuds. I held out for so long. I finally went on to Amazon, dropped the $40. It's life-changing. If anybody out there that doesn't have it, it's life-changing.
Yeah.
Bluetooth earbuds. Do it.
I would agree with that. I went a little further because I run a lot. So I got the Blue Birds or whatever. Blue Buds. I forget what they're called exactly. Jaybirds. Those things, they were like $150, but they're like sweatproof and stuff. It's amazing. I got like a cheap $20 pair, and like the sensor was here, and I'd strap my phone over here, and like the signal didn't even get through my head, apparently. Or my beard, I don't know.
Couldn't get through the beard.
Yeah.
It's not out yet, but I'm really looking forward to this website called People with two E's.
Oh, my God.
You're done. Get out. Oh, jeez. All right, Lewis, it's your turn.
I'll take another direction. I try to do at least one recipe a week that, like, total improv. So this is my first time using spaghetti squash.
Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So you just cut it in half, throw a little bit of water in, bake it for like 30 to 40 minutes, and when it's done, you just scrape it with a fork and it comes out completely like spaghetti strings.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really cool, like, mix with any kind of pasta sauce or stew you're going for.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah,
good one. Good one. I've tried that. It's great.
Yep. All right. So I think we're at the end here. I'll just say, like, I was so excited about this episode, and like it got me thinking. Actually, my wife came up with the idea, but I really liked it. And at the space camp, at Meteor Space Camp, we're having a hackathon on the second day, and I've picked up, we're getting ready to order some Raspberry Pis, and we're going to break everyone into random teams of four and hand them a Raspberry Pi and say, like, build something. It has to run on here, preferably with Meteor, and then, like, the two winning teams get to walk away with the Raspberry Pis. So, I'm excited. All right. Where can people find you, Ryan, if they want to catch you?
Yeah, if anybody has any questions, it's ryan@cabinetgrow.com, or if you're interested in the products, just go to cabinetgrow.com. If you're interested in maybe some of the other stuff we're doing, we just released a blog post. I wrote that, and that's cabinetgrow.com/blog. And on there, pictures of the hardware and more information about the actual technology layer and the camera systems and everything else.
Nice. All right. What about you, Lewis?
Yeah. Company website, grovelabs.io. We'd love it if you guys back us on Kickstarter later this month if you're looking for that. Personally, lewis@grovelabs.io. Other fun community stuff. We run the Boston Urban Agriculture Meetup. Love people to come by and check that out. And we're also hiring. So iOS engineer, software designers, and Meteor/Node backend engineers if you're looking for jobs in Boston.
Nice. Yeah, I'll have to get you in the Slack chat room, and we've got a jobs channel in there. You could post something. I don't think we have like a ton of Boston people, but you know, who knows? Maybe they're willing to move.
I used to hang out in Boston.
Nice.
One more shout out. If anybody's in the Orange County, LA area, we also run a group called OC Hackers. It's at a makerspace down here. So come on by. We use Meteor a lot.
Nice.
Cool. I'll take one of each of your products. Thank you.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for being on the show, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
Yep. Nice meeting y'all.
Nice meeting you guys.
Bye. Yeah.
This podcast has been a Meteor Club production. You can find out more information about Meteor Club at meteorjs.club. It's pretty easy to join the mailing list and stay in the loop. Again, that's meteorjs.club.